This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Everyone has their own methods of coping with stress during this pandemic, but here's one you probably haven't tried yet: tracking wild animals. That's what works for Sarah Spaeth, Director of Conservation and Strategic Partnerships for Jefferson Land Trust. This week on the Compass, we speak with Sarah about how she does it, why she does it, and how the wild animals react when she finally tracks them down. And now we go inside the Compass. In her role as Conservation Director for Jefferson Land Trust, Sarah Spaeth often uses her skills as a wild animal tracker, and it's not unusual for her to come face-to-face with black bears or cougars, but she's never armed or dangerous herself. We asked her about that and many other aspects of her job. I have a friend who knows how to track wild animals, but he does it while carrying a gun because he hunts deer and other animals for food. I suspect your reason for learning how to track wild animals might be different, yes?
Yes, that's true. But I appreciate the fact that people who are hunters also need the skills of a wildlife tracker in order to be able to follow animals and see them, whether they're hunting them to provide for food or trophies or for the experience of photographing them. So there are lots of reasons that one might want to learn tracking skills and trailing skills. And my appreciation for them is very layered. And I think in my conservation work, I have just had my eyes opened to who's really sharing this landscape with us. Being able to read the signs of animals on the land, I equate with, it's like learning how to read the first alphabet that we as humans had to learn how to read in order to be able to survive. Both because we were hunting animals for our food, but we were also sometimes being hunted by animals. And sometimes we were scavenging off of the kills of other apex predators. So those were skills that we had to have. So there's the sort of the technical component of learning how to solve the mysteries of who is there and why it is that they're there and what they're doing. And that to me has been beneficial for my work in conservation, because we know that the creatures that we share this place with need habitat, they need corridors, they need connected landscapes for their survival. And so the work of the land trust and our landowner partners has really benefited from understanding who's there. But I think the other part of it that I just really appreciate about it is that it really tunes us in with where we are. We have to use all of our senses to uncover the mystery. It includes not just that technical understanding, it's being present and picking up on these very subtle signs sometimes, and smells and feeling where a bear may have rubbed a tree. So I love that kind of, as I mentioned, layered aspect of learning the skills of wildlife tracking and experiencing this in the wild or in your backyard, for that matter.
Now, the pandemic has kept a lot of people locked down in their homes, but I think you said that tracking animals has been critical to your sense of well-being in these times. Tell us about that. Kind of visually or verbally, take us out on a trail and let us know how this calms you or soothes you or whatever it does for you.
David, I think I'm not alone in the midst of this pandemic that people discovered how important the solace of nature is, and that spending time outdoors, being in the woods, being on a trail, looking out over the water, it is food for our soul, and not just sort of emotionally, but I think physically there have been studies that have said that we need time outdoors. And for me, the focus of tracking is just another way to experience the outdoors. And what I found during the initial lockdown was that I just, you know, I walk my dogs every day, and I'm fortunate to live near some of the trails that the Land Trust has helped protect, and have neighbors that let me walk on their properties where there are little animal passageways. And in preparation for this Nature in Your Neighborhood wildlife tracking class that I was going to teach, I just said, you know, I'm going to really focus in on my neighborhood here. I'm not going to drive down to the duck bush to look for bear sign. I'm really just going to be here, and I'm going to see what I can see. And so I would set out on a walk in my backyard, and I would say, okay, today I'm going to find a rabbit pellet, or today I'm going to find a bird's nest, and I'm going to figure out whose nest that is. Or today I really want to see if I can find some bobcat scat versus coyote scat, and just really try and hone some of those skills and my experience of really nature in my backyard. And then, of course, as things loosened up a little bit, I did wander a bit further and hike some trails in the Olympics that I've never hiked, and take some more tracking courses and evaluations that also helped increase my skill set. And I just think that the tracking is just one lens that helps me experience landscape, but really it was so important for me to have that daily experience outside to connect me with nature and help get me through these challenging times that we're living through. And I think that a lot of people recognized the importance of that kind of nature experience as well.
So do you do this as part of your job, or is it really just kind of a hobby?
It's both, actually. It started off as a hobby, but I also really have learned so much through my tracking that does benefit the work that I do. When I apply for grants, I know who's actually living or transiting through the lands that we're trying to protect. And the Land Trust really is all about helping people connect with the lands that we live on or that we work on, and have different programs that we have employed over the last few years. In fact, this year we had a wonderful virtual program called Nature in Your Neighborhood. And we had 800 people sign up for this program. Wow. And it was an 8-week program where you could come and learn about how to identify the trees that were in your backyard, or what are the ferns that grow in our area. And I got to do a little spot on wildlife tracking and how do you learn to read the signs that are on the landscape. So there's definitely a connection between the work that I do with the Land Trust and my avocation of and passion for wildlife tracking.
In specific, what kind of animals do you track?
Well, whomever is leaving their sign behind. So that's also part of the really exciting thing that I've enjoyed getting to know, is who is here. And so it's not just a study of identifying them, but really understanding the behavior of the animal. Like, at what times of the year would you perhaps find this animal here? So oftentimes when I'm going to a new place, I will develop a list of all of the creatures that I might possibly see. And so when I first started tracking here, I had to kind of develop that list too. And there's some great reference books, and you can go through those books and look at range maps and determine, okay, well, we're likely to see cottontail here, but not jackrabbits. So really, it's whatever animal might be in the landscape is who you're tracking, who you're looking to solve the mystery.
What sort of species do we have here that you learned how to track?
Okay. Well, here, some of the smaller species might include deer mice and Pacific jumping mice and a couple of different kinds of rats, non-native rats. We have possum, we have mink, we have muskrats, we have beaver, We have voles, we have eastern cottontail, we have snowshoe hare, we've got bobcat. As you get larger, we've got the cat species of bobcat and cougar, and we've got coyote and black bear and river otter. And, you know, there's a host of creatures that are specific to our ecoregion and specific to the lowland Puget Sound Salish Sea area. And once again, you can kind of get a sense of who they are by looking at some of these reference books. And then the actual microhabitat that those creatures might inhabit. So I wouldn't very likely be looking for a beaver up in the high alpine area, or I might not be looking for a Pacific jumping mouse away from some sort of water feature because they're sort of close to that, or muskrat, for example. You know, you're gonna see those more likely near water body. So you can start to hone the types of creatures that you look for in a given area based on your understanding of animal behavior and lifestyle and that sort of thing.
If someone wanted to learn how to track wild animals, and it sounds like a fun thing to learn how to do, how would they go about doing that?
Well, I think there are a number of ways that you can learn how to track, and the guidebooks are really helpful as a starting place. One of my teachers has a great book called Wildlife of the Pacific Northwest, and that's written by David Moskowitz, and it's a great field guide for just a really broad brush understanding of the tracks and sign that you might see in this area. And Mark Elbrock is just a prolific biologist, has lots of great guidebooks on animal skulls, mammals of North America, animal behavior, bird track and sign. So really a wealth of information in those books. But I also think that the field time is so key to really starting to hone those skills of observation. And one thing that people can do is this practice of sit spot, where you find a place near your home or in your neighborhood, somewhere that's easy to get to, that gives you some quiet solitude and a place to just be in nature, and you spend time there regularly, whether it's 15 minutes every day or three times a week, and you just sit and listen and smell and feel and watch and start to see the subtleties of that place and see changes and make note of what it is there that you're experiencing. And then also, you know, take that same sort of observational skill when you're out and about. Look for subtle patterns that you might see in the landscape, like the shadow of a little game trail going off in the woods, or, you know, a scratch mark on a tree, and then use your reference guides to try to sleuth out what it is that you might have observed. And when you think about animal behavior, they're leaving these signs based on what their needs are. So it may be that an animal is transiting through an area because they're searching for food. And you may see signs of their feeding behavior, whether it's browse or, you know, an animal that they fed on, or the scat that they leave behind. Or you may see rub marks on a tree that a deer or elk has left, and that is a signpost that they're leaving when they're breeding, when they're getting ready to breed. And it's a scent post, and bear will leave signs like that. So you're really starting to just hone your observation by looking for things related to the animal's needs. And the books will talk about that too. Now,
have you ever been in the wild and found yourself being tracked by a predator of any kind?
I have not. No, I haven't. I think more often than not, we tend to frighten those animals away. I have been in the wild where I've gotten to experience some of the big animals that live in our area. Black bear, just this summer I was at the Duckabush, and there were lots of black bear feeding on blueberries, and they were pretty focused on feeding on blueberries, not really interested in me or my companions that I was there with. But when we got too close, they just ran off. So no, I haven't experienced anything that was like a threatening situation.
For those who don't know, what does Jefferson Land Trust actually do?
Well, the Land Trust is a conservation organization that has been around since 1989, and we help our community to protect habitat, working lands, and open space forever. And we do that with a set of tools that are quite common for land trusts across the nation. We own land in some cases that has high habitat value and protects habitat for salmon and other wildlife species that need corridors to migrate. We also protect working farms. And so we've had a big role in helping protect the farmland of East Jefferson County in particular. And we're evolving into protecting working forest land as well. And one of the common tools that we use outside of owning land is something called a conservation easement, where the land is still privately held by landowners, but they have agreed to a certain set of covenants on their land that help protect the conservation values of the land. And then it's the land trust job to ensure that those conservation values, whether it's the salmon stream that runs through it, or green belt of native vegetation and forest, or a scenic vista, is always protected forever. And we have an annual monitoring program, and we maintain relationships with landowners forever. That's our job once we take on an easement. Yeah, and to date, we've helped protect about 17,000 acres through those tools and stewardship agreements that we have with public agencies to help them steward some of the lands they own. So, been at it for a while.
You got an undergraduate degree in marine biology and a graduate degree in coastal zone management. Why and when did you make that shift to land-based conservation and tracking wild animals?
Well, after graduate school, I moved back to Port Townsend. I'd been here before that, but I moved back to Port Townsend with my husband and three children in 1993. And I did some contract work for the Marine Science Center back then, and then some consulting on marine resources issues, but was looking for more steady employment than contract work. And this job with this organization called Jefferson Land Trust came up in 1996, and I didn't really know what a land trust was, but I applied along with another person as a job share, and we were hired as Jefferson Land Trust's first full-time professional staff to coordinate the Quimper Wildlife Corridor project, which is still ongoing. It's a project to protect a greenbelt of native vegetation across the Quimper Peninsula, all the way from McCurdy Point to Fort Worden. So that's still happening, but the organization has evolved a long way since then, and I have learned a lot in my 25 years of working for the Land Trust, and just really, you know, still appreciate the landscape that we live in. But it's just been such a wonderful way to get to know this place deeply and appreciate this place deeply and the people of this place deeply.
It sounds to me like you grew up in two sort of disparate environments. Urban Seattle, I think, is where you started, and then the remote San Juan Islands. Tell us about the places you grew up and how they might have affected the course of your life interests.
Well, I guess they were disparate, but Seattle was a different place then. Growing up there in the early 60s, and I lived in a wonderful neighborhood that had green space in it near the shores of Lake Washington. And I think I was able to experience the wild and look out over Lake Washington and also experience the culture of Seattle at that time. Yet my parents they loved the outdoors, and they had been invited to spend time up on this little cabin on Guaymas Island near Anacortes. And so from the time before I was born, they were going up to Guaymas, which had a little 6-car ferry that would go over from Anacortes. And so from the get-go, I had this wonderful experience of the beaches and the shorelines and the forests of the San Juan Islands. And I think that was incredibly formative for me because I just fell in love with that and fell in love with the mountains. We'd go up in the mountain skiing and we'd go sailing in our old double-ended Block Island schooner. And I think that actually, that appreciation for wild, especially once I had children, I felt passionate about wanting to make sure that not only my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, everyone's children and great-grandchildren had opportunities to experience this amazing place that we live in. And that even then I knew that it was changing and that we wanted to make sure that there were places like Guaymas that people could experience.
You also worked on natural history boats in Alaska for a bit. What did you do on those boats and how did you like living in Alaska?
Well, we never really lived in Alaska. Our home base was here in Port Townsend. My husband is a shipwright and a captain and started a company called Pacific Catalyst that operated two historic, beautiful old wooden boats with really interesting histories, taking people on week-long natural history cruises in Southeast Alaska. So our season would be from April through September. I would go up and cook on board because I have a history of being a professional baker and cook also. So my thing was that when I could arrange for our kids to be taken care of by someone here at home, I would go and cook for a number of these trips and then also arrange to ensure that the boats were fully stocked with great food and great cooks when I wasn't able to be on board. And we were involved with Pacific Catalyst for about 10 years, and it's still operating, running trips up in Southeast Alaska on the Westward and the Catalyst, and also down in Baja. And it was a wonderful way to experience the wilds of Alaska, taking people out into these beautiful places. And now I would love to go back on board not only those boats, but some of the other boats that I've worked on up there with wildlife tracking skills and do that instead of working in the hardest job on the boats, which is cooking.
Yes. So you served as executive director of the Jefferson Land Trust. What were your duties in that role?
Well, like any executive director, you're overseeing staff. You're ensuring that the nonprofit has the funds to continue its operations. So, you know, donor relations and being the face of the organization in the community and working with lots of partner organizations and helping the organization grow, I think, really. I was the third executive director for the organization. And now for the past, 5-6 years, I think we've had our fourth executive director, Richard Tucker.
So it sounds to me like you're a very outdoorsy person, and that doesn't sound like a very outdoorsy job description. Did that have anything to do with you then moving to Land Trust Director of Conservation?
Well, when I was the executive director, I was also the lead on projects. So I was still the one negotiating with landowners and writing grants, working with staff to actually get these conservation projects done. So we hadn't really replaced my role as conservation director beforehand. So I was doing both, and I feel like I wasn't exactly operating in full capacity in either of those roles. And I think my passion and skill set really lies in the conservation work and working with these amazing landowner partners and partner organizations and funding organizations and private donors. And the administrative part of this work is not where my passion lies. And I'm thrilled that Richard loves that kind of work. So I think we work really well together because we both are the face of the organization, as well as other staff too. And I get to focus on the fun project stuff. And he likes to keep the machinery running on the inside. And that's great. It's been a great partnership internally.
I recently watched a documentary on the reintroduction of wolves into the environment at Yellowstone Park. Predators are often hunted to protect other species. And I think that's what they said initially happened in Yellowstone, but they brought them back. What are your thoughts on projects like reintroducing wolves at Yellowstone?
Well, I think that apex carnivores like wolves and grizzly bears and cougars really are important components of a healthy landscape, and that they support greater levels of diversity and more complex systems, and help with resiliency in the time of climate change. And so most people have heard of a trophic cascade, where the impact of that apex predator, say they kill an elk, a cougar kills an elk, well, is it just benefiting the cougar? Actually, they've discovered in studies that that kill feeds so many other creatures. Cougar kills can feed wolves or bears or deer mice or ravens or eagles. And so that's how that cascade takes place. Another example that I've understood they've documented in Yellowstone is that the prey species acts differently when there are apex predators nearby, and that natural response of a prey species was at play for millennium, and that without those carnivores on the landscape, the prey species are spreading out, they're having a greater impact on the landscape. By removing those wolves or those grizzlies or those cougar, you're having a multiple layered effect on that whole landscape. And I believe that our landscapes are healthier when we have those predator species at play, and that we have to find a way, and I think there are ways that we're finding that we can live in concert, in relationship with those prey species in our landscape also.
My last question is always the same. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you care to add?
Gosh, well, I guess just circling back to how important I feel it is for the people of this area to have a chance to experience and appreciate this place that we live in, and that we're really fortunate in that we have this abundant landscape with opportunities to get out into it, and that it's healthy for our own spirits. And it's also critical for these animals that we share this planet with, and that those creatures are a really important component of this whole web of life, and that there is a way that we can learn how to interface and live in harmony. That's a little cliche, but just to appreciate that we do share it with other species, and that there's a place for all of us, and that we humans are a part of the landscape as well. And I believe it's so important for our children to experience the wonders of the wild, that it makes for healthy people as well.
With Sarah Spaeth, Director of Conservation and Strategic Partnerships for Jefferson Land Trust, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon, with repeat airings Mondays at noon and 5 p.m., exclusively here on KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend.